We are still taking a look at some of these historical figures that were important in the time of the Reformation. And tonight I want to speak to you on John Calvin, of special interest to us, I'm sure. And a lot of people use his name, Calvinism, so forth. Not many people know a whole lot about the man himself. And there are a lot of misconceptions about John Calvin. He was a remarkable fella, to say the least. So I can't cover his entire life in one session tonight. We'll have part two next time, and then we'll have our Thanksgiving service the next Wednesday. So we'll go on to something else after we touch on Calvin. But let's get started. John Calvin was born. Anybody know what his nationality was? Swedish? Swiss? No. French. There you go. John Calvin was born on July 10th, 1509. Now let that date sink in. How old would he have been when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door? 8 years old. In other words, keep in mind that Calvin is much later. He's a second generation reformer. He comes along sort of at the tail end. Well, not the tail end, but when it was in full swing. But he was not one of the early ones. The early ones, if you want to think of Luther as the one that sort of got things rolling, Zwingli would have been early. But Calvin is much later. He was born at Noyon in France. Wesley, if you can, I've got a couple of maps for you to look at. We're making Wesley do double duty back there. Well, go to the other one if you would. That's a map of Switzerland. Okay, here's a map of Western Europe. And if you look at France over on the left, and you'll notice France is a little bit smaller than we see it depicted today. And the reason is because the border of France now, you see where Strasbourg is, right between the words Roman Empire, of the Holy Roman Empire. Strasbourg was then very much inside the Holy Roman Empire. What is Germany today? Today, Strasbourg sits on the boundary between France and Germany. So the lines have been redrawn after the first two world wars. But notice Noyon. If you see Paris there in the part marked France, 60 miles to the north is the town of Noyon. It was in the French province of Picardy. Originally, his family name was spelled C-A-U-V-I-N, Calvin, something of that nature. But it was Latinized into Calvinus. In fact, I have some work some people have done over in England titled Calvinus. That was his Latin name. Eventually, we shortened that to simply Calvin. His father was the apostolic secretary to the bishop of Noyon. Now, the important thing to pick up from that is that his father was a connected guy into the Catholic Church system. He had four brothers, two died early in life, and two sisters. At first, John's father had ambitious plans for him as a churchman in the Catholic Church. Through his father's connections and influence, John secured a chaplaincy, and that is a paid position as a bishop's assistant, sort of the assistant pastor, at the cathedral in Noyon at the age of 12. By age 18, he was also given charge of the church at St. Martin de Marteville, which furnished yet another source of income. Now, technically, he was too young for both these positions. And further, since he had never been ordained, he couldn't say the Mass. But it was very common in that day for a well-connected young man like John to receive such an office and the pay that accompanied being in that office, and then hire another priest to actually do the work. So it's like you've got the contract for the overseeing a church, and he's, 12. But you subcontract that out to a priest who can actually do the work. And that was a very, very common practice in France and in the Holy Roman Empire. For instance, Pope Leo X, who was Pope during the time of the Reformation, received the tonsure at 7. Anybody know what tonsure is? Tonsure is, you remember they would shave the spot. Some of us don't have to do that. But they shave the spot on top of your head. That is your initiation into the Catholic clergy. Well, Pope Leo X received the tonsure at age 7. He was made an archbishop at age 8, a cardinal deacon at 13. And besides all this, he was in charge of 3 cathedrals, a rector in 6 parishes, a prior in 3 convents, and an abbot in 13 abbeys, and the bishop of Amalfi. You know where the Amalfi coast is down southern Italy. And he derived income from all of those positions. So you get the picture. This is a money-making scheme if you're a churchman. This is a way to make a good living. So in Calvin's case, we can be thankful to the Catholic Church for at least one thing. It was the income derived from his chaplaincy at the cathedral at Noyon that enabled him to leave his hometown and to pursue his university studies in Paris. So the Catholics paid for his education through the position they had for him in Noyon. So at age 14, he left home and he entered the College de la Marque in 1523, studying grammar, rhetoric, and learning Latin. From there, he transferred to the religious College de Montaigu, where he studied philosophy and theology. What is especially interesting to me is that he stayed there for about 5 years. And the following year, just after he left, in February 1528, Ignatius Loyola arrived to study at the very same college where Calvin was. Now, that name may not mean anything to you, but Loyola is the founder of the Jesuit sect of monks. The Jesuits were formed by the Counter-Reformation. If you remember, the Catholics in about 1564, 65 had the Council of Trent, which issued all kinds of edicts against the reformers. Basically, if you believe like we do, you're headed for hell. And that was considered the Counter-Reformation. It was their counterattack. And the Jesuits were formed to be a scholarly group of monks who could argue against the Reformation. So here is Calvin, who is going to be one of the leaders in the Reformation, at the same college, just barely miss Ignatius Loyola coming there to study as a student, which is fascinating to me. So from 1528 to 1533, that is, he was aged 19 to 24. He studied successively at 3 leading universities of France, Orleans, Bourget, and Paris, the Sorbonne. His father had then decided that a career in law was far more lucrative than a career as a churchman. I know he's doing pretty good, but anyway, so he directed his son to apply for study for the legal profession. But after his father's death in 1531, Calvin turned away from the study of law back to the humanities and eventually to theology. He was noted for his learning and abilities, and he often taught in the place of his professors, and he was really considered more of a faculty member than a student. In April of 1532, Calvin is the grand old age now of 23, he published his first work printed at his own expense. It was a commentary on a work by Seneca, the Roman philosopher, entitled On Mercy, quote unquote. It portrays Calvin's abilities in the field of philosophy, Greek and Roman literature, as well as his skill in the Latin language. But it is purely the work of a humanist, not of a reformer. Now, if you remember, I was trying to share last time, humanism, we think today of secular humanism. This was another kind. This was coming out of the Renaissance, that basically said that rather than having to be dependent on the Catholic Church for all your knowledge and information, a man was capable of understanding it himself if he had access to the sources. That's the good kind of humanism. And so in a sense, all the reformers were humanists in that sense, religious humanism. But his first work showed absolutely no trace of any interest in the Reformation. He doesn't make any allusion to Christianity whatsoever. And so what it shows us is that Calvin, like other reformers, Melanchthon, Philip Melanchthon, who was there with Luther, Zwingli, there at Zurich, they all started out their college careers as humanists, admiring the heathen classics and pursuing a secular career as a moral philosopher. That's how they began. But in each of those cases, God had other plans. Now, the exact time and place of Calvin's conversion are not known. He stands very much in distinction against Luther. Now, Luther spoke very often about his conversion, the details of the great change that occurred in his life. Calvin, on the other hand, said very little. It most likely occurred at Orleans or Paris in the latter part of 1532 at the age of 23. Although he speaks of it as sudden, it was most likely the culmination of a very long, slow process. Calvin was neither an untaught pagan nor an immoral youth, but he was a devout Catholic of unblemished character. So his conversion was not so much a turning away from an outwardly sinful life as it was a turning from papal superstition to evangelical faith, from trusting in the efficacy of the Catholic Church to putting one's personal faith in the merits of Christ alone. One of the rare allusions that he makes to this change is found in the preface to his commentary on the Book of Psalms. And I've got that. I've read that out of there several times. And he makes this allusion while he's commenting on the life of David. Here's what he says. See if you can sort of pick up his story here. Quote, "As David was taken from the sheepfold and elevated to the rank of supreme authority, so God, having taken me from my originally obscure and humble condition, has reckoned me worthy of being invested with the honorable office of a preacher and minister of the gospel. When I was yet a very little boy, my father had destined me for the study of theology, but afterwards, when he considered that the legal profession commonly raised those who follow it to wealth, this prospect induced him suddenly to change his purpose. Thus it came to pass that I was withdrawn from the study of philosophy and was put to the study of law. To this pursuit, I endeavored faithfully to apply myself in obedience to the will of my father, but God, by the secret guidance of his providence, at length gave a different direction to my course. And first, since I was too obstinately devoted to the superstitions of popery to be easily extricated from so profound an abyss of mire, God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was more burdened in such matters than might have been expected from one at my early period of life. Having thus received some taste and knowledge of true godliness, I was immediately inflamed with so intense a desire to make progress therein that though I did not altogether leave off other studies, I pursued them with less ardor." So his conversion was not nearly as dramatic as Luther's, but it was every bit as thorough and lasting. Again, you can't always judge someone's conversion experience by the emotional thing going on or how dramatic it is. Sometimes people's conversions are very quiet and under the surface, but there's a huge change going on within. Now, a lot of effort has been expended by scholars trying to figure out the why Calvin suddenly embraced the cause of the Reformation. There are several possibilities. Some have pointed to the influence of his family and friends. One of his relatives, Olivetan was his name, had earlier embraced the Reformed faith and studied with Martin Bucer at Strasbourg. Now, Martin Bucer was, you know, almost all these major cities in Europe now have reformers there. Joachim Lampadius over in Basel, you've probably never heard of him, but he was the reformer there. Martin Bucer was at Strasbourg, had a lot of contact with Luther, had a lot of contact with Zwingli, and as we'll see, then has a lot of contact with Calvin. So Bucer was one of the lesser known reformers, but has a very important role to play, and one of Calvin's relatives studied with him. So that may explain a little of his attraction. His younger brother and sister would later follow Calvin to Geneva. And 100 years after his death, another member of the family left Noyon for Geneva and embraced the Protestant faith. So these facts, some have deduced that there must have been some sort of anti-Pope bias in the family or sentiment in the family, but we don't know for sure. Then others point to his university training. His Greek and Hebrew teacher was Melchior Vollmar, a humanist and a pupil, and here's another name you probably have never heard of, Lefebvre de Tople. Well, he was one of the earliest reformers in France. Lefebvre was a well-known figure, had a great influence on a lot of folks. Well, anyway, this Greek and Hebrew teacher of Calvin sympathized with the Reformation and may have had quite an influence on Calvin. And then there's another thing going on. During his training as a lawyer, Calvin was consulted concerning the divorce of Henry VIII. Y'all remember the story of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn and all of that. When that question was proposed to and debated by the scholars in universities in Europe. Now, see, we think, you know, something goes viral on Facebook or the Internet, and everybody's talking about it. Well, the same thing is going on in Europe over these issues, like the divorce of Henry VIII. And it's happening in the universities because they're the ones who have the sort of the information, and they've got the scholars there to discuss these things. And I would go on to say it would have been impossible to have been a student in these universities at that particular point in time and not to have been exposed to some degree of Reformation thought and ideas. Because, again, this was the hot topic of the day. It was what was being debated by the educated classes throughout Europe, and especially by scholars and students at schools such as the Sorbonne and those universities in Paris where Calvin was a student. So it's somewhat similar to what I remember. Y'all maybe Noel that dated Jessica from Canada. Noel, anybody remember Noel? He didn't make the cut. But anyway, Noel, he wound up at Southern University, and he worked for, who's the head of the university there? What's his name? At Southern University, Southern Seminary. Al Mohler. Yeah, he worked for Al Mohler. And so he was my source of a lot of good stuff that he was sneaking to me out of Mohler's library. He would make copies and stuff and send me all the good stuff. But he was saying, he said, and that was very early back there at Southern Seminary before Calvinism really was rooted. And he said, when we get in our dorms, we're all sitting out in the hallways and it's Calvinism is what we're discussing. That's the hot topic on campus. The same thing is going on in France and across Europe in the universities where the scholars are. The Reformation is the big news of the day. So you see. And then there's another thing. At one point, a friend asked him to introduce his sister to the superior of a nunnery in Paris, which she was wanting to enter. And he complied with the request and made no attempt to dissuade her of her action. But what he does do, however, is to admonish her not to confide in her own strength, but to place her whole trust in God. And that may give you some hint as to the change that was taking place within him. Anyway. Whatever the case, at the ripe old age of 24, I'm thinking, kids today at 24, I'm sorry, who's 24 here? Anybody? Caleb, how old are you? 20. Yeah, Caleb, see. I mean, just look at Caleb. I mean, you know, no, you're fine, Caleb. But kids today typically at this age are still trying to find themselves, still playing video games on their mother's couch in the basement. You know, here is Calvin, and this is at 24 now. It finally came time for Calvin to make an open break with the Catholic Church. Here's the situation. Calvin had a good friend, an older student at the University of Paris, whose name was Nicholas Cop, and he was elected to become the rector of the University of Paris in October of 1533. So the rector is sort of the president, we would say, of the school. And on All Saints Day, November the 1st, now let's think, what happened on the eve of All Saints Day in 1517 was when Luther nailed his 95 Theses. So this is now 1533, 16 years exactly later. Cop delivered his inaugural speech. They were installing him as the rector of the university. And this speech was thought by many to have been written or at least influenced by Calvin. It contained a bold plea for the reformation of the church on the basis of Scripture and a challenge to the hearers to no longer tolerate the abuses of the clergy. The Sorbonne, and you run into that expression, it's the faculty of the University of Paris, as well as the Parliament, because remember, church and state are one, saw this speech by Cop as nothing less than a declaration of war upon the Roman Catholic Church. So Cop was forced to flee to relatives in Basel, Switzerland. Calvin, who was the supposed author who wrote the speech, apparently, his story is he descended out his window by the aid of a bedsheet, and he escaped Paris dressed as a wine dresser with a hole carried over his shoulder. He managed to escape the city just as the police were searching his room and confiscating his books and his writings. So both of these guys barely got out alive before the Catholics would have seized them. Well, that's, you know, early in his life. Now, for the next 3 years, from 1533 to 1536, Calvin wandered as a fugitive under assumed names in France, Switzerland, and Italy. And though King Francis I was quite hostile to the Reformation, he was King of France, his sister, Queen Margarita of Navarre. Navarre is the region down between Spain and France. Who is it there that's wanting their independence? Catalonia, yeah. That group of people in there. That's the area that Queen Marguerite ruled. And she was very sympathetic to Reformed ideas. So Calvin spent most of his first year on the run under her protection in southwest France. It is thought that it is here that he began work on his most famous literary work, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. Calvin's Institutes, that's the short name for them, is probably one of the most influential books that has ever been written. It's known that towards the end of 1534, he took a rather risky trip back to Paris. And there he met a Spanish theologian named Michael Servetus. Remember that name. We won't get to the full story till next Wednesday night. But this guy is going to play a very prominent role. Servetus had just published a heretical book denying the doctrine of the Trinity. And so Servetus challenged Calvin to a debate, and at great risk to himself, I mean, he would have been arrested on sight had the authorities known he was in Paris, he accepted and showed up, but Servetus never appeared. And so that sort of set off the bad blood between Calvin and Servetus that will escalate, and we'll see how that happened next time. Then when persecution broke out in France in October of 1534, Calvin, accompanied by a friend, fled to Switzerland. They were robbed along the way. They arrived utterly destitute at Strasbourg, but there they were assisted by the reformer Martin Bucer that I've mentioned. And after a few days, they journeyed on to Basel, Switzerland. Now, Basel is where Erasmus was. Remember, Erasmus was the guy that published the first Greek New Testament in 1516. It is where the reformer Oecolampadius was. It was a center of scholarship. It's really, Calvin kept being drawn back to Basel, Switzerland. It was there that Calvin, at the ripe old age of 26, finished and published the first edition of his institutes. Now, it's going to go through a lot of revisions, and it's going to be much longer than it was in this first edition. But it was an instant hit, you could say. It spread throughout all Europe. It thrust Calvin forward as the foremost champion of the Protestant faith at 26. It was published first in Latin. A few years later, it was translated into French. It was essentially a manual of the Protestant faith. Although you have these reformers, Luther, Zwingli, Bucer, Melanchthon, all these guys are preaching all of these places. No one had put together what we would call a systematic theology of the Protestant faith. That's what Calvin's Institutes was. It was an attempt to bring together of the various topics dealing with the nature of God, the nature of Christ, nature of the atonement, nature of grace and salvation, to bring all those things together in one book, one manual. That had not been done before. The Catholics immediately denounced it as the Koran and Talmud of heresy. But the Protestants declared it to be the clearest and most convincing defense of biblical Christianity since the days of the apostles. That is quite an achievement for a 26th. Well, after his institutes were published, Calvin left Basel and crossed the Alps down into Italy. For a few months, he enjoyed the hospitality of the court of the Duchess Renee, daughter of Louis XII of France. But persecution again threatened, and Calvin was forced to flee back to Basel. And from there, he made a final visit to his home in Noyon to settle some family matters. His father had died. He went back to fetch his brother and his sister and to bring them back to Geneva. So and keep in mind, he's on the run. He's operating under assumed names, trying to stay out of the reach of the authorities. So he's gone back to his hometown after his father dies to get his brother and his sister and to take them to Basel, Switzerland. However, and this is simply the providence of God, a war had broken out on the border there between France and the Holy Roman Empire, and the direct route to Basel, which would have gone right through Strasbourg, was blocked because of the fighting. This forced Calvin to swing to the south. Now, notice the green block of stuff, that's Switzerland. Okay? So instead of going through Strasbourg and going down the Rhine River, you see the river running up there, north and south, he is forced to swing around to the south and to enter through Geneva. I don't know if you can read Geneva there, right on the border of France and Switzerland. He arrived in Geneva just after his 27th birthday in July of 1536. His intention was to stop only for the night and then to go on his way to Basel with his brother and his sister. But the course of events that happened there is going to change the course of his life and story of Christianity, really. There was a man in Geneva by the name of Guillaume Farel. We would say William Farrell. Again, he's one of those names that most people have never heard of. But this guy had been a reformer. He was a fiery personality. He had the character of a prophet. He was 20 years older than Calvin, and he had been a devoted Catholic in his youth. And while attending the University of Paris, he became under the influence of Lefebvre, the guy I mentioned earlier, de Tople. And through Lefebvre's influence, Farel thoroughly came to embrace Reformation teaching. And he was very much used to introduce Reformation ideas all over Central Europe. For several years, he traveled in France, Switzerland, and Italy, attacking Catholicism. And in 1534, and that's 2 years before Calvin shows up, Farel had come to Geneva and began working for the Reformation of that city. And he began to convince the authorities there to go in the direction of the Reformation. And gradually the tide began to turn there. priests, nuns, monks began to abandon the city, and even the bishop had to relocate to a friendlier venue. In the summer of 1535 and again in the spring of 1536, the Council of Geneva declared itself for the Reformation. The Mass was abolished, images in churches were removed, schools and hospitals established. And by the time Calvin arrived, Farel immediately sensed that he, Calvin, was God's man to complete the task of Reformation in Geneva. Of course, Calvin was known in Protestant circles all over Europe. But Calvin argued strenuously that he was so young, timid, and in need of more teaching, more instruction, and he wanted to pursue the life of a scholar. Farel replied by threatening him with the curse of God if he chose a life of quiet study and scholarly pursuit instead of the cause of Christ. I could not put my hands on it. I have a biography of Calvin by Emanuel Strickelberger. If you can get that, get it. And in that that biography of Calvin, he quotes what Farel told him, and it's stiff stuff. He says, "May God damn your studies and your scholarship if you choose your own course rather than the cause of Christ." Well, Calvin couldn't sleep that night. And the next morning, he announced that he would submit himself to what he perceived to be the direct call of God on his life to remain in Geneva and seek the reformation of that city. Now, Farel was a magnificent guy when it came to tearing things down. I have met some folks like him. As I read the description of him, we had some of those guys around in the early days of the Sovereign Grace movement. They were really good at tearing things down. Roth Barnard, you've heard me speak of him. He was one of those guys. Mean as a snake, but God used him in a mighty, mighty way in a lot of churches in the South. But you wouldn't have wanted him to be your pastor. Let me put it that way. He wasn't the guy that's going to come hold your hand when you're in the hospital. He was a rough, rough guy, and he was dealing with some rough things. Well, Farel was exactly that. He was a great guy when it came to trying to tear down the institution of the Catholic Church, but he also recognized the need of someone else to come along to build up and edify the church, to build it up. And even though Calvin was 20 years younger than Farel, Farel recognized and yielded to the superior intellect of his young friend. And on the other hand, Calvin always treated Farel with the very utmost of respect, and there was never the least hint of any rivalry. So we're going to leave the story right there. We'll pick up next time with part two. There's just too much. Anything surprise you? Anything jump out at you? His age. Yeah. To write what we call Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, at age 26, published at 27, and spreads throughout Europe, it becomes the manual of Protestant theology. It did not have much impact in England because of the distance up to England and the difference in language, but all over the continent of Europe, that is the book that if you could get your hands on it, this explains what Protestant Christianity is all about. And to think he wrote it at 26. Anything else? Yeah. How'd that work? What you've got in Switzerland is a confederation of what are city-states. You have a prominent city. Let's take Zurich, for instance, is the prominent city. That's where Zwingli pastored. And you've got the city council. And keep in mind that there's also a province, a canton, they call it, C-A-N-T-O-N, like Canton, Mississippi, a canton that is the sort of county. These are states, but they're very small, okay, about the size of our counties, that surrounds Zurich. So you have the city of Zurich and then the canton of Zurich. And the city council in Zurich then determines what is taught in the churches in their canton. There is no separation. Keep in mind, and of course, this is one of the criticisms we would have, that the Reformers utilized that church-state system. But really, you had two choices. You could either then try to reform the city-state, to try to get the authorities on your side, to convince them that what you're teaching is correct and get them to impose that religion in that area. Or you can do as the Anabaptists, simply check out. I mean, the Anabaptists fled and lived underground, basically, in a separate commune. So you either had to go one extreme or the other. And some of the Anabaptists went that direction. The Reformers went the other direction. And so what you've got going here is another example of that. Geneva is the county seat, so to speak, of one of these cantons. And so what you've got to do is convince the city council to basically drive the Catholics out and establish the Reformation religion as the religion of that particular area. So it's a very different society than what we're familiar with. And keep in mind, this is exactly what has gone on with Catholicism for 1,000 years, 1,500 years, is that they not only rule the religious world, but they rule the secular world as well. There really is no distinction. And so you've still got that system in place. And so they're having to work within that system to some degree. It makes sense. You see, well, by this time, it was open warfare. By this time, the Catholic Church was doing everything they could do to stomp it out. Protestantism in France, they were known as the Huguenots. They were Calvinists, Protestants in France. Keep in mind, that's Calvin's home nation. He had a huge influence on the Huguenots in France. But they would be eventually driven out of France. Was it Louis XIV revoking the Edict of Nantes? They had been given freedom of religion at one time. And Louis XIV, I believe it is, who revoked that and gave them an ultimatum, either get out or I'll kill you. And several hundred thousand had to flee France, including, on my mother's side, which are Hardens, Marc Hardoun came from France as a Huguenot to this country, first Hardin we can find here. So I'm a very good stock, in case you're wondering. So that's the idea. No, it's open war. The Catholics catch you, they'll kill you at this point. Does it hit you that what we call Calvinism was not in any way unique to Calvin? Calvin didn't start what we call Calvinism. He simply compiled it, what was already being taught by Luther. You can get Luther's book, The Bondage of the Will, and you can read it, and you'll see already Luther was what we would call a Calvinist, even though Calvin wouldn't be along for 20 years after Luther. All Calvin did is bring the various strains of Reformation teaching together in this manual. So he didn't invent anything. And even they didn't invent it. Luther was an Augustinian monk studying the writings of Augustine, or Augustine, sometimes called, from 400 A.D. These were simply things they were already reading in Augustine. Things like predestination and election and so forth. The things we call Calvinism were not really in any way invented by Calvin. Now, he popularized them, sure enough, and systematized them through his Institutes of the Christian Religion, you see. That's where the publishing of these doctrines came. But he certainly didn't originate it. So Calvinism is really not a real accurate name at all. In fact, reading Charles Hodge, some of his systematic theology, he refuses to call it Calvinism. He calls it Augustinianism. He says that's a much more accurate term if you want to attribute it to to one man. And then he'll make an argument that it's really not Augustine at all. It's Paul. That's where he got it from. So anyway, this sort of misunderstanding we have that Calvin came up with all this stuff. No, he simply brought the various teachings that were going on all over Europe in the Reformation together in this manual. And it was through that that everybody then began to learn of these doctrines. Yes. Okay. All that went out the window. Yeah. No, he was just wanting to be a divorced Catholic. That's what he wanted. Yeah. That's right. No. No. But it is interesting that the continental reformers and the Reformation in England are very different, very different. And the things that went on the continent of Europe, some of the things, the Puritan things later on, they had nothing in common in many of those areas. But it's too complicated a thing to go into. Servetus, remember that name, Michael Servetus. Calvin has already had one encounter with him. And one of the strange things is Servetus not only wrote this anti-Trinitarian book that started off sort of the feud between he and Calvin, but he also wrote the first book that described the circulatory of blood in the body. He was a well-read man. He knew a lot about biology. So it's amazing to me how these guys, how learned they were. But if you go back and think about Calvin starting, by age 12, he's already plugged in. He's got a church under jurisdiction, even though he's getting the money for it. He's somebody else to do it. But they're already in the universities. They've already know Latin. They were extremely well educated. The few that could get an education. And you had to have something like Calvin's father, somebody that was plugged in and connected, could pull strings for you to get you into those kinds of schools. Average guy wouldn't have a shot. Anything else before we? A 7-year-old bishop. Yeah. Well, what's really amazing is Leo. That's Pope Leo. 7-year-old bishop, archbishop, I think, by 7. And all of those rectories. A rectory is a group of buildings that house your nunneries and your monks and so forth. So Leo was not only over the nunneries and then the monks, but he's over the buildings that house them. And I mean, how many, go back and look at that, the sheer number. Well, it's not what you know, but who you know. You've learned that, Joe, right? Well, I don't see it here. But again, it's just incredible. Yeah, here it is. This is Pope Leo the X. This is before he's Pope now. He received the tonsure. That is, he gets his head shaved. He's in the Catholic priesthood, in the ministry, we would say, at age 7, an archbishop at 8, a cardinal deacon at 13. And beside that, he was in charge of 3 cathedrals, a rector in 6 parishes, a prior in 3 convents. That's a prior is the head of a convent, okay? An abbot, that's the group of, an abbot is somebody over an abbey. An abbey is the buildings that house the nunneries and the convents, okay? He is an abbot in 13 abbeys, as well as the bishop of Amalfi, that whole area down off the east coast of southern Italy. And he gets money from every one of them. These are all paid positions, supported by, keep in mind, the church and state are essentially one, so your tax money goes to support the church, which then gets paid to these guys to do their job. I don't know. He was apparently plugged in, shall we? Well, what's fascinating to me is you would, at age, 8, you're named a bishop. You can't say the Mass. You haven't even been ordained. But you hire a priest who can say the Mass to do the work. You get to rake in the big money and hire the guy to do the work and keep the difference. But keep in mind, before you complain too much, that's exactly how John Calvin went to the University of Paris on the Catholic nickel, because he was receiving money for being the head of a church in Noyon, France, when he wasn't even old enough to shave. Anyway, okay. Well, we'll come back. I hope you find this fascinating. I mean, this history is remarkable in so many ways. But yeah, the age of someone like Calvin, how early he knew this, is amazing to have the grasp on theology that he had at such a young age. Well, we need to spend some time.